The event's goal is to raise funds to cover the cost of housing and medical procedures for spinal muscular atrophy for two children who've been evacuated from Ukraine. Pre-show refreshments start at 6 p.m., and the 7 p.m. concert will feature award-winning flutist Anastasia Petanova and pianist Brandon Joe, who will perform pieces by Ukrainian, Romanian, Hungarian, and French composers. That's Standing Together at 6 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th at the Covenant Presbyterian Church. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The European Parliament has approved what it calls a trailblazing law on the use of artificial intelligence. The President of the Parliament, Roberta Metsola, said the new rules balance technological innovation with respect for people's fundamental rights. Chris Vallance reports.
The rapid advancement of AI has led many countries to take steps to regulate the tech. But with the parliamentary passage of this act, the bloc believes it has taken a lead. The act regulates AI according to risk. It severely curtails some tech, such as live facial recognition cameras, which will only be usable by law enforcement to tackle the most serious crimes, and bans others, such as AI emotion detection systems in schools or workplaces. High-risk uses of AI, for example in medicine or critical infrastructure, will also face tougher rules. Violators will face fines of up to 7% of their revenue.
Lithuania has blamed Russia for a brutal assault on a close aide to the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Leonid Volkov was attacked in the capital Vilnius on Tuesday. Lithuania's president Gitanas Nausėda called it a pre-planned assault that tied in with other Russian provocations. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford listened to him.
He said it was a planned attack. He said it was in line with recent events in Lithuania. But he also said, as well as stating that this attack would be investigated fully and he hoped that those responsible would be found and would be punished, he also said that he had a message for Vladimir Putin. And that message was that nobody in Lithuania is afraid of Mr. Putin. But I have to say that this attack will have worried Alexei Navalny's team. Most of them, many of them, had moved to Lithuania in recent years.
The United Nations says it's delivered urgently needed food to northern Gaza for the first time in 3 weeks using a new land route. Famine is looming in the territory after nearly 6 months of fighting, and pressure is growing on Israel to allow more access. The Sudanese army and its paramilitary rivals from the Rapid Support Forces have vowed to continue the battle for control of the country, ignoring international calls for a Ramadan ceasefire. The RSF remains in control of much of Khartoum as well as the western Darfur region. Barbara Platt-Usher reports.
The head of Sudan's army has pledged to pursue the Rapid Support Forces everywhere until complete victory is achieved. Reports said Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan made the comments after his troops recaptured the headquarters of the state broadcaster on Monday, a significant advance against the RSF. The army appears to feel it has momentum, and if anything, fighting has intensified since the beginning of Ramadan, rather than diminished. The UN had called for a ceasefire during the Muslim holy month, warning of catastrophic humanitarian conditions.
World News from the BBC.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Banzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glassnickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly 5 decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, March 13th, and this is the 8 O'Clock Buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. So this morning, I'll be speaking with Oscar Mireles, founder of Latinos Organizing for Understanding and Development. The group is a statewide initiative focused on promoting collaboration between Latino arts and service organizations, artists, and the communities where they work. Oscar Mireles will be with me this morning to talk about the work of LOUD, and remind you to come and see the Women's History Month exhibit at the LOUD Gallery at Omega School. Many of us know Oscar. Oscar Mireles was a poet laureate for the city of Madison from 2016 to 2020, has served on the board of directors of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, the mayor's appointee to the Overture Center, and a board member of the Madison Symphony Orchestra, and of course as the executive director of Omega School. So stay tuned to hear from Oscar Mireles. Also, I'll be speaking with Karen Dolan. Karen Dolan is the director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I'll be talking with her about her post-parsing President Biden's 2024 State of the Union address. She says President Biden credited progressive economics with a strong post-COVID recovery, but on Gaza and immigration, he failed to draw much distinction with his conservative opponents. So we'll be hearing from Dolan about her take on the State of the Union and also about the president's budget proposal that was released this week. And then later from Democracy Now!, an excerpt, a piece with Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa. So stay tuned to hear that. Stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back. is 8:10, and joining me is Oscar Mireles, founder of Latinos Organizing for Understanding and Development. Latinos Organizing for Understanding and Development is a statewide initiative focused on promoting collaboration between Latino arts and service organizations, artists, and the communities where they work. And, you know, many of you know Oscar Mireles. He was a poet laureate of the City of Madison from 2016 to 2020. He has served on the board of directors of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, has served as a mayor's appointee to the Overture Center for the Arts, and is a board member of the Madison Symphony Orchestra. And, of course, many of us know Oscar as executive director of the Omega School. Hey, good morning, Oscar Mireles. It's great to have you on WORT.
Well, thank you, Jan. Thanks for including me in on your show.
It's great to hear your voice, and I'm sure people are happy to hear from you, too. Really wanted to make sure people come out to see the Women's History Month exhibit at the Loud Gallery at Omega School. But before then, for folks who Loud is new to them, can you tell us about the history? You folks were founded in 2016.
Yeah, as when I became Poet Laureate of Madison from 2016 to 2020, I was asked not only to do things with poetry, a number of organizations asked me to kind of get involved in the various forms of arts, whether it was at the museum or with public radio or with other things. So I felt like I needed a vehicle to kind of do that. So it had been things I had already been doing informally, but I just thought it would be a great way to focus my energy and resources and the supporters I have to really promote Latino art, support Latino artists, and help others who are doing Latino programming in the area.
And in this part of the state, but are you also outreaching statewide?
Yeah, we've done, as a poet and a kind of a community speaker, I've done things in Stevens Point, at Viterbo University, at my alma mater, Oshkosh. And in making these visits, I've shared some of the work we're doing. So we're in the process of really creating little mini tours. So when I bring an artist to Madison, about a year ago, I bring in a musician, and ended up being in Wausau. So we were at the Grand Theater, and I made some connections there. And then they also performed in La Crosse. So yeah, so it's a natural extension of some of the networks that I've had, and we're looking, as I move on and retire from Omega, we really want to create a season of events that cover across the state. By working cooperatively, we can lower the cost, and I can help them both with fundraising and kind of logistics. So we're pretty excited, and I see a bright future.
The acronym is LOUD. Can you talk about why you want to be loud about all of this?
Well, Latinos have been in this country for a long time, and in Wisconsin, Latinos is the largest ethnic minority group for the past 10 years. And so we're in every county, we're in every school district. So we just want to celebrate the growth of the population. We want to celebrate just the diversity. I was looking at an exhibit in Milwaukee, and there were dozens of artists that I had never heard of. So to me, that's exciting. Some people might say, well, gee, maybe they're not out there. Oh, they're there. They're out there. And that's part of the LOUD. It's to give them a voice so that the general public and specific communities know who they are and what they're doing.
And, Oscar, you've always just been such a constructive force in organizing and in the community. And, you know, in these times when there's so much destructive forces out there, you know, I think, you know, it's important to be organizing this way. What do you think about the need for constructive voices?
Well, I did, before I was poet laureate, I did three anthologies titled I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin. And I had published, self-published a book in the mid-80s. And then I said, you know, people were really excited for me and excited for the book, but they didn't know how to pull it together. So when I did the first anthology in 1989, we had 20 poets. And for half of them, they had never been published before. There's a system for all these kinds of things. There's a system to get published. There's a system to do readings. And if you're just there in your bedroom writing, that's a key part of it. But the next step is how do you connect and engage? So since then, I did a second and third anthology, and the third anthology, with the support of the former poet laureates, we were able to have 40 different writers. So part of my history has been that collaboration, and when you pull all the different poems and artists, it is a collective voice. That doesn't mean we always agree. But there's a spectrum of experiences that Latinos have, whether they're recent immigrants, whether their family has been here for multiple generations. There is a sense of longing for home. There is an embrace of language, culture, and food. So, yeah, so these projects are just an extension of what I've done in the past.
And you know, something constructive is, and encountering all the negative and destructive noise out there, is the Women's History Month exhibit at the Loud Gallery at Omega School. And people still can come by. We've got the rest of the month. Can you talk about that exhibit and the themes, the artists?
Well, as you mentioned, Women's History Month is in March of every year. We had a Black History Month exhibition, which got a lot of rave reviews. But the Women's History Month, I wanted to focus on portraits, and so it is a series of portraits. But as I was reaching out to some artists, and some artists reached out to me once they heard about it, you know, it just. Couple things that came through is one, you know, the strength and resilience of women to really kind of both shape social movements and to shape the whole kind of family and community. Women have always been at the forefront of making changes in the community, because even though sometimes it's only men in the room trying to make decisions, it's really the support. And in these portraits and paintings and digital art, it demonstrates the beauty and power of different diverse and BIPOC women across the country and across the world.
Can we mention some of the artists, or that would it be unfair to mention some and not all?
yeah. So some of the artists are Sophia Volker. She's a Caribbean artist, and she did a portrait of an African-American woman, and she interspersed kind of flowers, and so she calls it flower power, but it is really a very colorful. But underpinning the photo is this beautiful, dynamic woman, and just an air of grace, just a powerful kind of very, you know, not much else in the background. We also have a photograph of a woman from India by a local photographer, Catherine Zebdeblik, who has traveled around the world taking photographs. But I remember her showing me some of her prints, and I said, that's the one I want, because it just shows this woman just, you could just feel, you know, her sense of stature in that community. You can feel her love for her family. And it was a quick kind of stop, can I take your picture kind of pose, and it still has that impact. We also have a local painter who's had a lot of work on the Umoja magazine, Jerry Jordan. He did a portrait of his wife, and it's Naira Jordan, who's at American Family, and it's just such a loving kind of painting. If you could, you know, put love in a painting, he's done that. And, you know, she's just seated at a chair, and you know, you wouldn't, it's not romantic, it's love. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a wide range of, we also have a younger artist from Milwaukee, Rosalia Singh, and her father was a muralist I worked for 20, 30 years ago, Reynaldo Hernandez, who has some of the large murals in Milwaukee. And she has this Caribbean kind of background. And, you know, one of the things I noticed with a lot of the portraits is the women didn't look directly at you. So they're sort of a beauty in them, both in a reflective pose and just a dignified pose, because they're, you know, looking people in the eye and all those kinds of things sometimes, you know, sends a different message.
Now, you say women have played a big part in your life. I read in an interview you gave, you mentioned your mom and your sisters.
Yeah. I mean, my mom, you know, my mom was such a, I had, you know, 13 brothers and sisters, so it's hard. It's just hard. There's a lot of people that you have to love, and my mom was able to do it. I just remember she'd be making tortillas, and I was a lot smaller in stature back then. I was 85 pounds when I was a ninth grader. So when you're that small in stature, the world looks a lot bigger than it is, and it seems overwhelming. But I just spent a lot of time just with my mom talking. She'd be making, you know, the family meal and making tortillas, and she'd try to stop me from eating all the tortillas as soon as they were done. But, you know, just gave me a sense. And as I got older, she said, you know, you always have a place to live, and you'll always be fed. It's just that we can't, you know, you got to know you always have home with you. And you don't have to be here to kind of know that. So that kind of support and strength, you know, and that's what I feel with my current wife, Diana. I feel like I have that support and strength now, that I'm able to take on new projects and initiatives and feel like I got that support at home. And then my two sisters, my one sister was a singer. Unfortunately, she died early of cancer, and my first public performance was I was a little cowboy in the talent show. So I had a checkered shirt and a pair of jeans, and she ended up singing the song "Walk On by Dionne Warwick, and she just showed me that, you know, that art is something that's inside you, and you have to share it with the world.
Yes. You know, when you said 13 kids, and that's a lot of people to love, it's such a that captures so much, Oscar. And I'm glad that I asked you about family, because that was really just great to hear you talk about that. The show, tell folks where they can see the show that is a celebration of Women's History Month at the Loud Gallery. So where is it located, and when can people come in to view it?
Yeah, so the Loud Gallery, it's called the Loud Gallery at Omega School, and it's here at Omega School. We did an extensive remodeling with a new roof and heating and air conditioning, and then we painted the walls and new flooring. It was a 28-year-old building. And as we were doing this, I noticed we had some track lighting there, and it sort of never occurred to me, well, shoot, we could have an art gallery here. And so as we were finishing up the construction, we were able to really kind of create a gallery space. So that happened last May. And so it just ended up, I know National Women's Month was coming up. And the school is open from 9 a.m. to 7:30. So people are welcome just to park in the back, even though it might say no parking, and come to the front door and ring the doorbell, and the staff will let you come in and walk and see the show. We did have an opening ceremony, and for those listeners, actually, I have a luncheon tomorrow. So if people call me, you can join me for a lunch we're having tomorrow with one of the artists, Christy Tirado, who's from the Pacific Northwest, and she's finishing up her MFA, but she does some amazing woodcut. So if any listeners want to come, if they can email me so I know how much food to order today, they can join us. So tomorrow from 11:30 to 1, we'll have an artist talk. So.
And best to email you?
OM at omegaschool.org.
Hey, Oscar, before, and so folks, you still have time to contact Oscar about tomorrow's event. But now, in terms of upcoming events, mark your calendar kind of, just kind of giving people a heads up. There will be a Latino Arts Fair this May?
Yes. Loud cooperating with the Latino Chamber, which has been running the Latino Art Fair. So it'll be, the Latino Art Fair will be Saturday, May 4th, 2024, at the Overture Center. It's in cooperation with the Madison Symphony Orchestra. So Latino Art Fair will be a musical kind of performance at the Overture Center. We'll have mariachi demonstrations by Mariachi Los Camperos from Los Angeles. And there will be a youth mariachi, Latino art string program from Milwaukee will be performing. And then we have a Colombian group, Cumbia Cacacha, they'll be performing. And then at the Commonwealth Gallery, we're doing a Cinco de Mayo Latino Art Fair show on the themes of freedom and independence. So on gallery night, May 3rd, we'll have artists opening, and right now we have about a dozen artists already committed to showcasing their work, but we still have a couple of openings. So that's what we have, and then we'll have our Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos. We'll have altar-making workshops, and that'll be Friday, November 1st, again, back at the Commonwealth Gallery. We're fortunate to partner with Commonwealth, and they really supported kind of what we're doing there with the art exhibitions.
So mark your calendars for May 3rd and 4th. Coming up is the art fair. And then, in the blink of an eye, it's going to be November. So mark your calendar there so you don't miss these special events. Hey, Oscar, it's so good to talk to you. I mean, I just enjoy it so much. Oscar Morales, the founder of the Latinos Organizing for Understanding and Development, and just a great joy to talk with this morning, Oscar. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Jan.
Hey, it's just about 8:29, almost 8:30. We're going to take a short break, and then coming up with me, joining me will be Karen Dolan from the Institute for Policy Studies. So let's just take a break, and then we'll be catching up with you in a second. We'll be right back. Just past 8:30, and joining me is Karen Dolan. So Karen Dolan is the director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted to talk with her about her recent post there at the Institute for Policy Studies site, parsing Biden's 2024 State of the Union address. President Biden credited progressive economics with a strong post-COVID recovery, but on Gaza and immigration, he failed to draw much distinction with his conservative opponents. So I wanted to talk with Karen Dolan about that, and also about the president's budget proposal that was released this week. So good morning, Karen. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Jan. It's lovely to be with you.
Hey, Karen. So, you know, I'm just going to ask you just kind of, what was, you know, you watched the speech, and, you know, what was your immediate reaction afterward?
I'm very encouraged by President Biden's economic populist approach. I think that he is speaking to the economic needs of most of us and is rejecting this disproven theory of trickle-down economics that we've had as a noose around our neck for decades. So I'm very encouraged by that, and I think that his budget proposal reflects that same sense of economic populism.
So I wanted to just kind of break it down in terms of the price of medications. Can we just talk about how that has come down?
Yes, so there is legislation that was able to include a provision by which Medicare can negotiate lowering drug prices. Right now, that only applies to a few high-cost drugs that are covered under Medicare, and most explicitly is the price capping of insulin at $35, and then out-of-pocket costs for seniors at $2,000. What President Biden expressed his desire to do, both in the State of the Union address and in his budget proposal, is to get that expanded for negotiation of drug prices lower across the board, and for an insulin cap at $35 for everyone, and out-of-pocket prescription drug costs capped at $2,000 per year. So it isn't Medicare for all, but it's a big step in that direction. And I think that is where we need to go as healthcare gets increasingly unaffordable.
Now, the state of the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so your listeners might remember during the pandemic, the American Rescue Plan was a big package that helped to keep our heads above water during a global crisis. So people were losing their jobs, especially frontline workers were especially hit. Low-income people of all ethnicities were hit. Everybody really was. Supply chains were stopped up, and people needed help. And the silver lining in that is that Congress was able to finally see the right way to helping people, which was many programs, but specifically expanding the child tax credit. So they made the credit, they made more children eligible, whereas before, poor children were not eligible. So if your incomes are too low, the people who need it the most were not able to get the child tax credit. So during the pandemic, people who needed it the most were able to get it. They were able to get more money for each child, and very importantly, the tax credit was made available monthly, which was critical in helping people pay their rent, pay their mortgage, pay their car payment, get their groceries, pay childcare. So that was critically important. It was so important that we saw that child poverty was cut in half. However, Congress did let that expire. They did not renew that, and we saw child poverty spike right back up to the top. So both in the State of the Union and the budget. So his budget proposal is just putting on paper, you know, the specifics behind what he spoke about at the State of the Union. He, President Biden, is calling on Congress to restore that expanded child tax credit the way it was in the pandemic era that helped so many. And similarly, we had an expansion of the earned income tax credit that would help low-income workers who don't have dependent children at home. So the budget would restore these very important programs and tax credits that were available during the pandemic.
Was there anything in that speech that was new to you that you were pleased to have him address in terms of economic policy?
I don't know how much was new beyond restoring some very popular programs that I am very pleased to see him championing. There was one new provision that was surrounded taxing private jets. And at the Institute for Policy Studies, we have a project that looks at the cost, both financially and to the environment, of corporate jets and how that increases income inequality. And I urge people to go to ips-dc.org to see an analysis of that. That was a new provision.
Now, in the speech, I think in his budget, he calls again for increasing the corporate tax rate, the minimum rate, correct?
Yes. So what's very interesting, what's very heartening about this is just a wholesale rejection of trickle-down economics that we have, as we spoke about, that we've been living with that shadow for decades. And study after study after study has shown all that does. So trickle-down economics is the idea that you cut taxes for the most wealthy and the biggest corporations. And so somehow their windfall will trickle down and increase wages and jobs for the rest of us. Well, that doesn't work. Studies show that all it does is increase the wealth of those at the top and increase inequality. So by writing our tax code, in terms of correcting our tax code so that it is more fair, so that wealth, the very, very wealthy and the wealthy corporations are not paying less than a school teacher or you and me. In some cases, we know these billionaires are paying zero for taxes. So he's calling on closing those loopholes so that the very wealthy don't get away with paying nothing or paying less than their fair share. He does want to raise the minimum tax on individuals making more than $100 million in wealth to 25% minimum tax. The Trump tax cuts that took place in 2017 are set to expire in 2025. Biden says, let them expire. Whereas in Congress, the Republicans have released a budget document that calls for extending and increasing, in some cases, tax cuts for the wealthy. We should let those expire. We should tax capital gains at the same rate as earnings for those with over $1 million in income, and increasing the corporate tax rate to 28%. So there are a number of tax provisions. Shoring up Medicare, for example, by increasing to a small amount tax rates for those earning over $400,000. So these are tax increases that are very reasonable, and they are for people in most cases that are making, you know, over $100 million in wealth. There will be no tax increases for anyone making less than $400,000. And indeed, for those making less than $400,000, we'll actually see tax benefits from these tax credits.
And if I'm reading this accurately, I'm just reading something from the AP that it would generate like $5 trillion over the next 10 years, these tax increases.
That's right. So that's why... So if we want to move into some of the specifics of the budget, what we see is a proposal to really invest in American families, in our communities. So these tax credits that we were talking about that help people with children, that help workers who don't have children. There are also proposals to reduce housing costs for first-time home buyers, to help with rental assistance. I mean, we're in an economy where rents are going sky high, the cost of homes are sky high. There are proposals to help with the cost of childcare and to increase the number of childcare facilities across the country. Also the same for community-based care for aging people and people with disabilities. On top of that, helping those care workers and teachers at Head Start, at preschool, at elementary school to get paid fair wages. It protects our nutrition programs. It shores up shortfalls in the nutrition that women and infants and children and people who can be pregnant and postpartum and nursing, that they're able to get food, including very critically fresh fruits and vegetables. And it protects Medicare and Social Security insurance and Social Security. And there are infrastructure additions and expanding broadband and development into rural and urban areas and cleaning up our waters. So people would say, well, that's very costly. Well, practically, it really isn't. If you implement these reasonable taxes that I just spoke about on the very, very wealthiest and close those loopholes, you raise over $5 trillion in revenues. And that more than pays for these wonderful programs that I just talked about and protecting and securing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
I mean, this is why, you know, you have politicians with the power to, you know, vote for or against this stuff, to, you know, reject and be sort of even be repulsed by Trump, and yet they say they're still going to vote for him, right? It's this part of his policies that they love and really fear Biden about, do you think?
Yeah, I think objectively when you have a politician who is supporting, protecting wealth at the very top at the expense of the rest of us, that is not, those are not policies and those are not values that help anyone except the very wealthy, except those who need it the least.
You know, folks were disappointed with other aspects of his speech, with regard to his policy in Gaza, immigration. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So there's kind of whiplash, I think, with Biden's policies and expressions of values, both in the budget and as he spoke about in the State of the Union. On the one hand, we have this economic populism, this right-sizing the federal budget, that's another piece too that we can talk about, is that the overspending, obscene overspending on the Pentagon budget that takes away from making progress to the extent that we really need it in the budget. So all of these proposals that he put forward are great steps in the right direction, but they don't go as far as we need them to go, which they could go if we didn't, if we weren't spending $1 trillion per year on the militarized budget, which brings us to Gaza. So most people in this country, you know, bipartisan according to polls, are opposed to what many in the international community say is a genocide in Gaza. So Biden is picking up rhetoric opposing the slaughter of children and babies, and now they're on the brink of famine, and there's no way for humanitarian aid to get in there. So he's using the language for that, but as long as he's still sending weapons to Israel, which he is, then that is so much lip service. You can pick up better language than he had, say, a month or two ago, but he's still sending weapons. So until weapons are not being sent anymore to the aggressors, it's very hard to take much comfort in his words opposing the aggression, what many people will call genocide, of the Israeli government. And then similarly on immigration, I think that Biden missed a big opportunity to talk to the nation about how important immigration is to our country, how, you know, the studies were just released. I think it was from the OMB, from the Office on Budget and Management, that we will be missing out on $7 trillion of money in our economy over the next 10 years if we restrict immigration. It points to how critical immigrants are to the functioning of our country. And then on another level, just in terms of how vibrant our communities are, how vibrant our schools are, how diversity is what built this country, diversity is what is important to this country, our frontline workers are immigrants. And Biden did not talk about those things. Instead, he talked about getting the border bill passed, which indeed restricts asylum seekers, people who are fleeing and have asylum cases. It would restrict that. He is, in my view, his position is very hard to contrast with the conservative view that is very anti-immigrant.
You know, that was a figure in your piece that really did stick out to me. The Congressional Budget Office predicts that restricting immigration would cost the U.S. economy $7 trillion over the next 10 years, and it just shows the dependency, right? You know, this, as you say, this speech, this budget, you know, the misalignment of our core values. You know, what do we do with this, right? But you know, I guess we each will have to think about that, Karen. But I appreciate, you know, your helping us understand and point out some of these key pieces in the president's budget. Karen, before we say so long, anything about the budget now that we should just be looking out for that will happen next, because it was released this week?
Well, we should remember this is a statement of values. This is not something that would be enacted, especially in divided government. But what it provides for us as engaged citizens is to tell our members of Congress, we want you to vote for this. We want you to support rental assistance. We want you to support the restoration of the child tax credit. We want you to support nutrition assistance. We want you to support raising taxes on people with over $100 million in wealth and closing corporate tax loopholes. We want you to support this. Also, on the parts that aren't good, such as the $1 trillion a year that goes to war and militarism, that we don't want that. We want the Pentagon budget slashed. We want that money to go towards healthcare for all, Medicare for all, to end homelessness, to end hunger in the richest country in the world. So we have to, and we want an end to the genocide in Gaza. We want an embrace of immigrants. We want a path to citizenship for dreamers, which I will say Biden is calling for that. That is the one positive aspect of his immigration message. But we have to help change the narrative on immigration. So I hope that people will go out and really, with their neighbors too, change the immigration, the narrative on immigration. Talk about the truth of immigration, how wonderful it is for this country.
And let our leaders know what we liked and what we didn't like about all of this. That is just I think, important to say. Hey, thank you. Karen Dolan, Director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Great to talk with you this morning.
Thank you so much, Jan. Bye-bye.
It is 8:52, and we're gonna turn now to a piece from Democracy Now! Amy Goodman interviews Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa. We're gonna try and play most of that for you before we get to the top of the hour. So here is that interview.
Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its attacks on Gaza as Palestinians mark the first day of Ramadan. The death toll from Israel's five-month assault has topped 31,000. For more on the situation on the ground in Gaza, we turn to part two of our conversation with the Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist Susan Abulhawa. She is the author of a number of books, including her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin. She's founder and co-director of Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's group, and the executive director of Palestine Rights Literature Festival. She joined us last week from Cairo, Egypt, one day after she returned from a two-week trip to Gaza. I asked her about the level of trauma that the children in Gaza are experiencing.
The trauma is immeasurable, frankly, not just for children, but for everybody. I spoke with a lot of women in particular who were recovering in a hospital or were there being with their children who were recovering. The stories they told me are out of like a Hollywood horror film. I mean, I have photos of the backs of men where Israeli soldiers carved pictures, smiley faces, Stars of David, etc., in their skin. These women narrated stories to me of, Israeli soldiers laying hundreds of women on the ground and then taking their guns with the laser and laughing, and then wherever the laser landed, they shoot. I spoke with a woman whose three-year-old daughter had both of her legs shattered, and she was in the hospital recovering. It was an intentional, she was intentionally shot by a soldier. And this happened to her daughter after they killed her son, shot him through the head in what she described as tank fire, toying with them for about 30 minutes before they finally delivered the final blow that took her son. People being forced to walk from hospitals, severe injuries, people being forced to walk for hours to get to safety, children in people in who were fleeing their homes trying to get to the south, having to walk with their hands up with their IDs, and if anybody dares to look down or pick anything up, they're picked off. They're literally shot by snipers. the scenes that they narrated to me, I spoke with a little girl who was about 8 years old, whose face was badly burned, but her injuries were the least in the whole family. The entire family had third-degree burns all over their bodies. And what she explained to me, again, you know, I don't know how a child survives that. I spent time in a hospital in a maternity ward where there were newborns who were unknown or who were known but whose family was just absent and no longer there, or nobody knows what happened to them. These newborns are spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in incubators without any human touch, really, except when they come to feed them, because the nurses and the doctors are so exhausted and so overworked. People are being discharged from hospitals with wounds and going into tents where they don't have running water and proper hygiene, and they're getting horrible infections and dying from sepsis. Life on the beach, the beaches where Palestinians used to go for fun, to love, to be with family, and it's torture now because a lot of tents are pitched in the sand, and the sand is in everything. That people's skin is scorched. I mean, children walk around with cracked cheeks from the sun and sand. The sand gets in every bite of food. The food that does come into Rafah is primarily canned food, and most of it, and I think you hinted at this earlier, and I've seen it and tasted it myself, it is stuff that has clearly been sitting on shelves for decades. And all you can taste really is the rancidity, metallic taste of the can. People schedule their days, they plan their days around trying to get to a single shared bathroom that's shared by hundreds of other families. They try to do their best with hygiene, but it's impossible. And when people succumb to living in filth, people, you know, I think maybe people in the West sort of have this impulse thought that most Black and brown people sort of live like this. So it's a little humiliating to have to explain that we don't actually live in filth, and it's degrading beyond anything you can imagine to be forced to live like this months on end, to have no way to protect your children, no way to give them hope, no way to calm their fears. You know, there's no privacy in the tents, because there's not enough tents for families. So families are actually separated with dozens of women in one tent and dozens in another. So spouses cannot even hold each other at night when they need that care the most. It's these details that are traumatizing en masse for children, for parents, for elderly. People don't have medicines. People are dying from lack of insulin, which, by the way, Israel has banned from coming into Gaza, and they're dying from diarrhea because they're drinking polluted water, and Israel has also banned water treatment, water filtration systems, even handheld ones, simple personal water filtration systems that Americans use when they go camping. It is, the degradation is total, Amy, and and on top of that, they're bombed day in and out.
You can hear the complete interview on the Monday program, Democracy Now!, for March 11th. Susan Abulhawa, Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist. Thank you for tuning in this morning. Thank you to Dave Lawrence, our music producer and engineer. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, March 13th.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day that United Auto Worker members won an 18.5-cent hourly raise after a 4-month strike against General Motors. After World War II, workers grew increasingly frustrated. The war years were a time of labor peace, as most unions agreed not to go out on strike in order to support the war production efforts. But during the war, as companies raked in profits, many workers felt that they were not receiving a fair share. Worse, wartime shortages saw the price of consumer goods skyrocket. A dollar simply could not stretch as far as it once had. After the war ended, the workers wanted to make up for the ground they felt they had lost during the conflict. A wave of strikes washed over the United States. Walter Reuther led the auto workers out on strike on November 21, 1945. Their demand was a 30% raise. Reuther publicly argued that General Motors could afford to pay the raise without raising the price of their cars. He urged the company to open its books so the public could see their finances. The UAW laid out its reasoning in a report entitled Purchasing Power for Prosperity. The strike wore on for more than 100 days, but the union had done a good job making its case to the public. Finally, General Motors agreed to a raise, as well as improved benefits such as a better recognition of seniority and promotions and protections for the union members. The contract was seen as a huge step forward for organized labor to take a seat at the table with capital. The strike and its settlement solidified Reuther as the leader of the UAW and a powerful voice for workers. Labor history.